Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This episode of Forecast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code FORECAST8.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast, episode 88. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Scott Johnson.
And this is the show where we gather together and try to get a little peek into the future with a couple of guests every week. Joining us this week, Annika Jong, Director of Digital Media at Bread, a performance storyteller and cheeseburger fanatic.
True. The secret's out.
All of those things are true. Man, I've been really wanting a cheeseburger today, too, actually. I was talking about that earlier.
You know, I heard you guys talking about In-N-Out earlier, so yeah. You must be familiar with their secret menu.
Oh, yeah. Animal style and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So last year, I actually put away an 8x8.
Eight
patties, 8 cheeses.
I have seen a man eat a 20x20.
Oh, my gosh.
One man,
Richard Migliozzi.
I doff my hat to you, Richard Migliozzi.
And he lived. He did.
Just barely, though.
I know. Thanks for joining us, Annika. Also joining us, Brian Huff, digital content producer for CBS, freelance web designer, developer, podcaster, and co-host of The Creep.
Hello. How's it going?
Who's he co-host that show with?
Some random guy. I can't remember who it is.
Plus, it's a rarity that we even get to do an episode because that game has nothing to talk about. But when it does, oh, my gosh, it's magic, Brian. It's great to have you.
It is great. It's wonderful to be back.
There'll be another StarCraft release.
Yeah, by the time StarCraft 4 comes out, we'll have another episode.
There you go.
All right, we're going to skip right past our listener predictions today and get right into the predicting. We had a few technical difficulties getting started on the live stream, so let's start with you, Annika. A short-term prediction, maybe something you think will happen in the next few years. What are you going to lead us off with?
Sure. So my first prediction is related to advertising. So I think one of the coolest things that Google did was totally change the way advertising was done on the internet, right? So it went from kind of like that punch the monkey banner ad, and they turned it into actually serving up content that is more relevant to what you're looking for kind of in search. So what I think is really neat is all of these new entities that are coming up to help deliver you, not necessarily advertising, but really meaningful recommendations from trusted sources. So that's really the direction I think it's going to go. And frankly, the way that we've seen advertising in the past, I think is going to go away. And we're going to just see a fundamental shift away from the spam and more towards, you know, what do you like? What do your friends like? And how do we use social to get that information to you?
So Annika, I agree with you and I actually think that this has to happen because we have become too jaded. Nothing in the traditional sense of advertising works on us anymore. I don't believe what I see on screen. When I was a kid and I'd hear about Otter Pops on a Saturday morning, I get super excited, tell my mom, we got to go get these things. And it was working on my infantile mind. The way the ads work today do not have that effect at all. Now, sometimes if it's in my wheelhouse, something I'm interested in, then I'll see it and go, ooh, that's cool. We'll go to that sale or that's the thing I'm interested in. But it's really less about the method they're using to talk to me and it's about the thing. And I would have figured out the thing either way. So let me ask you this question. If that is the future, if they're going to figure out ways to advertise to us that change the way we think about the sort of thing, that'll be more effective or whatever, do we not run the risk of just having that cycle happen again? Do we not just become jaded to whatever new medium or new methods that advertising throws at us?
Well, I sort of feel like you need to move away from this kind of mindset of tricking the consumer into liking something they maybe didn't want and moving towards, you know, what kind of things were they already interested in, right? So with social media, we now know so much more about not only you, but also your friends and your networks and kind of what you're around and what you're into. And I think being able to leverage that, you know, you have these now Facebook recommended ads and retweets that are just sort of at the fringe of that. And we're starting to see more opportunities to see what do my friends like, because I'm probably going to like the things that my friends like. And the more that we can make those recommendations based on people's networks and based on what, you know, kind of they're already surrounded by, I think the better it's going to get.
It seems like advertising has been mostly about brand awareness up until now. It's been about getting your product known so that people at least know it's out there and are more willing to go and find it. And so that's why you get hammered with hundreds and thousands of ads out there, because they need to hit you a million times before you actually remember what the product was. Do you think that this will be more effective at getting you aware of things that are more relevant to you, so that you don't have to be hammered over the head by 500,000 ads, you know, saying, oh my gosh, this thing again? Maybe you just need to be told once or twice.
Definitely. I mean, I think you have to think about where the trade-offs are, right? So they say like a picture is worth 1,000 words. I would say a recommendation from a friend is worth 1,000 nameless billboards. So I think like we are going to be able to cut down on the amount of noise that we experience if we can increase or improve the quality of this kind of advertising or whatever it'll be called in the future.
Brian, go ahead, Scott. Let's see what
I was
going to
say the same thing. Because Brian, I know Brian, he's working up there in Seattle. He's doing some cool stuff with different kinds of media. I mean, really, your job is to figure out ways to get messages across in non-traditional sort of new forms so that people aren't, you know, just going to turn you off immediately. How do you see the future of advertising and how well people can sell products to you, B-Huff?
Well, it's interesting how it's evolved, because I work in a very strange place, because I work for the radio group for CBS, but I work on the digital side. So radio kind of started where it was just that brand awareness beating you over the head. So when, you know, I walk into a grocery store, I think of a Kit Kat bar. And it's kind of moved from there where it became, okay, let me show you the products as a visual representation. And then the web kind of took you to a new place where it's like, oh, I can kind of demonstrate this product and show it to you, but still it's generalized. And I think Facebook took the first step, whereas let me put these ads in front of you based on your what you'd like and things like that. I think the next step in this evolution is this whole influencer concept, where it's not let me put this ad on TV or let me put this ad on the website, but let me get somebody like a Tom Merritt or Scott Johnson to market it towards specific people, and not in a way that it comes off as an advertisement. It's like, hi, you know, I'm using this ad, this app. This app is so awesome. I want to use this. That's really where it's moving to next. I think we're a ways off before a recommendation from a friend is controllable. I think that's the big issue is, yes, it's good to say, I get this, my friend likes that, but how do you control that? How do you make that a tangible item that you can sell and control? And I don't think we're quite there yet. And I think that's why they're looking to the influencers, because I'm not scared of the influencers. I'm not thinking they're trying to lie or cheat or steal to me. So I think that is where we go next before we go all the way to the point where I'm just literally taking a recommendation based on my thoughts that are in the social network.
Yeah. And it seems like traditional mediums of advertising, like, I don't know, a Terry Tate commercial still works for some because it's funny. It's viral, whatever. Those sorts of kinds of advertisements, I still think have some merit. Sorry, Tom, to invoke your name. But I feel like if we are going to get to the next level, I think Annika's right. I think there's no other way than to figure out a way to harness your friends and people you trust, and figuring out ways to say, if we're going to use traditional mediums here, let's say we're still going to have TV and we're going to still advertise to you, but we're going to be a lot smarter about what you see, then I'll go tell them right now what I want to see. I know exactly what I want to see from commercials, and I know the kind of places, things, and stuff that interest me. And those kinds of ads can come, and I will not skip them. I'm interested in a sale at Best Buy. I'm interested in a new Apple product. I'm interested in something Google's doing. So I think they can already get this about me. The trick has been for traditional media to figure out a way to pull that out and actually approach me with these, you know, with this kind of message, because they're not very good at doing that at all. Go ahead.
I think it's something like Hulu has the perfect opportunity to do, and they haven't leveraged as much. They put those ads up and they put, you know, is this ad relevant to you? But how much does that really affect which ad you see? Maybe like, okay, we're not going to show you that Ford ad next time, but collect that information. And after a while, if I'm watching a Hulu program and you know that I always click, you know, computer shows, computer ads are important to me, then you can market those towards me, and you can go to a company like Best Buy and say, look, we have X amount of people in our database that say that computer ads are relevant to us. And then you market those directly towards those people. And it goes to what you were saying is, you know I want to see that. I'm telling you I want to see that. So show it to me. It becomes far more effective. But I haven't seen them leverage that as much as you would hope.
Yeah.
Well, just one quick thing to build on what Brian was saying, that, you know, you're looking for some kind of a way to manage this process of recommendations. Part of the reason that I'm so passionate about this is my first prediction is because that's exactly what we're trying to do at Bread. So I'm trying to do that every day at work, finding ways to pull a lot of the noise off the internet and really make those recommendations more about what you're interested in, what your friends are interested in, and then what kind of trusted sources and influences in your life are all about. So that's kind of where we're starting. I don't think the industry is by any means there yet, but I think social media is at the forefront. It's going to be pretty interesting to watch.
All right, let's shift it over to you, Brian. Your short-term prediction, next few years, what do you see?
I think the big thing in the next few years is going to be an overhaul of the patent system. But to kind of ride off of that, I don't know if you guys have read that awesome article about where the patent system isn't broken, we are.
Yes.
And I think it makes some really good points. But my prediction actually is I think we'll swing too far in the opposite direction, because there's a very small subset of the patent process that's broken. And it's specific parts of the software area where it's like, I can come up with this generalized idea that doesn't require algorithms, doesn't require math, and it's literally like, sell an app in the app store. You know, I draw you a diagram, and then you get these LoadSys type companies. I think there has to be something coming down the pipeline where that, we end up revamping that. My concern is going forward that we're going to revamp that too far and cut off a lot of innovation in the software space to try to stop that from being a problem.
So interesting. If patents keep coming up on this network and everywhere else, and as a novice to patents, I hold no patents, by the way. I don't know if you do, Tom. Tom, do you hold any patents?
No, but I'm going to get one so then I can have leverage over you.
Right. So I obviously, most people are in agreement that there's something busted there. But Brian, don't you think it's going to take I'll ask you, what do you think it will take politically? What will it take socially? What will it take corporately for the patent system that we know and love today or know and hate today? To change in a way that is beneficial for this brave new world we live in?
I think once it starts squashing innovation to the point where it starts hurting the economy, we've had all this conversation about things like startup visas and that are holding up, or at least perceived to be holding up, innovation in this country. And I think once that starts to affect the widespread sector of the tech industry and not just, you know, one and two man shops that are producing iPhone games, I think that's when they step up and finally have to make a change. I just don't think, you know, in the little bit of patent law that I've studied, I think the problem is finding a way to just single that portion of it out without looping in everybody else that you don't want to affect. Because you want people to come up with these complicated search algorithms for Google and things like that. You want them to be able to patent that, because that there's real innovation here. But you don't want it to be something where, you know, I start a company, go out and buy a bunch of completely vague patents that anybody could come up with this idea without the use of this documentation, and then just make a bunch of money off of it. And I think until that starts to affect some of the big companies, and I think we're heading there. I think once it really starts to hit Apple and Google and Microsoft in the pocketbook that these small developers aren't able to develop apps freely, I think that's when we finally get a change.
Well, yeah, I think we're seeing that with LoadSys, and I think we're already feeling the effects. There are whole departments. Mark Cuban wrote a good article about this. There are whole departments that would not need to exist in companies if it weren't for constant patent battles, for lawsuits. It's a drain on companies' money on top of innovation. So I think you're right. There's going to be patent overhaul. We're going to have to make sure it doesn't go too far, because there is a good reason for patents. And there's even an argument for software patents. It's just a matter of figuring out a new definition that applies to the current situation. Our patent law in the United States was created in the late 1700s. A whole different situation going on there about how long things took and what kinds of things were obvious that the courts have been trying to interpret. And it really needs a legislative intervention. I'm worried, as you have expressed, that we might get it wrong if we go in and change the law. Annika, do you have a perspective on the patent situation and how that affects what you do?
I mean, I think this is definitely a hot topic right now. One of the best pieces to cover it so far, my favorite radio show is This American Life on NPR. They did a really, really good show a few weeks ago about patents. So they interviewed Chris Sacca and a couple other folks out of the tech world. And it seems to me the biggest challenge there, and I don't even know that we're going to necessarily solve this in the short term, is that patents were brought in to help kind of monetize innovation, right? So you can put a dollar value, so to speak, on it, and there, people are actually getting some kind of value in exchange for being innovative. And I think the biggest challenge is that once you put value on it, a market can be built. And I think what we're doing right now is just struggling against our own desire to have markets where we can buy and trade these, and it's sort of gotten away from us. So I think that's one of the big challenges, and I'm not sure that we're gonna fix that right away.
It feels like there needs to be, the logical side of me says there needs to be some sort of review system that says, all right, well, there is, but when you say, okay, I patented double clicking something, at some point we have to go, no, wait a minute, that's silly now. Like, that's too ubiquitous. That's too much of what we do with mice.
But when someone first created a mouse and double clicked, that should have been patentable, no?
No, I totally agree. Yeah. So at the time, you think about that and you go, oh, yeah, double click. That's awesome. Let's do that. Well, immediately that thing becomes just so part of the fabric that at some point you have to look at it again and go, all right, well, that's not a good patent. That patent is kind of like we need to breathe in as well as breathe out when it comes to computers. So I don't know who does the review process or who should do the review process moving forward, but it seems to me like it should be some sort of, I don't know, combined or all the interested parties. Somehow we should have some sort of consortium of various manufacturers, software developers, or whatever the area of interest is, and let them decide. And as I say that, I realize, well, maybe one of them holds the patent on double clicking and they have now a vested interest to protect that. I mean, it gets ugly and it gets.
Well, the patent and trade office
really
does exactly what you're talking about. It's just nobody thinks they do it very well.
Process on the back end, maybe do we control this from the standpoint of transferring patents? Because the bigger issue, the issue, I don't mind Google and Apple fighting it out over who created a touch interface. That they're the companies who create it and they have the right to defend that. I think the bigger issue is these patent trolls or these companies that are going out and buying patents. Do we need to look at the process when those patents change hands and review them then? As far instead of doing it initially at the front, because I agree there, you have to have some sort of gateway for innovation, a way to protect that. Because the double clicking thing seems intuitive to us. The touch interface seems intuitive to us, but 5 years ago, no one would have thought of any of it. So there has to be some reason to do it, but you also have to find some way to control it on the back end when it's becoming solely about monetizing it and not about actually protecting innovation.
Right, and that's a good point. And this American Life episode that you were talking about, Annika, which was awesome, also infuriating that episode was. I was so irritated after I heard it. But the whole point is that it isn't that, like you said, let Apple and Google or whoever fight it out over specific patent issues. Let them do that, defend it, whatever. What we're talking about is some small startup with very little money trying to innovate in some office in Cupertino, trying to make something awesome, and then finding out 3 days later that they've been, you know, asked to come to court and fight over some patent they're supposedly infringing upon. And that's where we need to stop it. I like what you say, Brian, the idea of stopping it or reviewing it before the exchange can happen. It's kind of like saying, you can't buy this house until we've all signed off on it, including the buyer, the seller,
mediator. If it's deserving of being patentable, why would that change?
It still could hold up. That isn't the issue for me. The issue for me is let it hold up and let it stand if it's worthy of standing. But now there's got to be a way for that.
It shouldn't have been issued in the first place. That's my point.
If Scott starts a company and just for the sole purpose of collecting patents to make money off of, how's that protecting innovation? Obviously, the company that originally created is no longer interested in it because they've sold it off, or you've got something where like Google buys Motorola. That's my problem with it. It's not so much that the patent shouldn't hold up, but when it's being bought for the sole purpose of making money off of it, when you're not the original innovator, it's not protecting that innovator anymore.
Annika, is there an argument against that?
I mean, I think the big challenge here is that transfer process, right? I mean, like, so you keep bringing up, Tom, you keep saying, you know, maybe we're having a challenge with having too many patents go out for things that aren't really patentable. I think that's really a separate issue from you know, this discussion of patent trolls and people that are just kind of scooping them up. So it may be that it's broken in two ways, and we need to look at them separately.
I kind of think if there wasn't as much supply, you wouldn't have as much of an opportunity for patent troll companies. But I also think, you know, that if we don't have the ability to sell our patents, there's less motivation to make them. Some people actually patent ideas with the idea of like, well, even if I don't end up turning this into a valuable product, I'm going to patent it because I could sell it. It's a valuable thing to have. And it may turn into a valuable product or not. That's, you know, that's something you don't know. If the patent itself isn't valuable from the beginning, they may be less likely to try things. That's, I'm not saying I'm 100% believing that, but that's one of the arguments for allowing patents to be sold. I think,
well, then let the transfer stop there. Make it be transferred to a person who is going to then use that patent.
Well, that's an interesting idea, saying, you know, if you hold a patent, you have to demonstrate that you're exploiting it or it falls into public domain.
Exactly. Yeah. So if I sell it to you, you have to be able to create a product. And that review board would say, well, you're not purchasing it in order to create a product. You can't show me you're capable of making this product that you're purchasing the patent for, so therefore you can't buy it. That will stop you from buying it for the sole purpose of attacking others.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you don't make a product, then people go, where's your product? And you say, no, wait, we're still working on it. We got one.
Well, that's why I say they have to demonstrate they can make it. You know, if I were to buy some Google patents, so they'd be like, yeah, you're sitting and you're there making little pretty websites. You're not going to be able to create the next iPad. It'd be kind of obvious. If you look at like Lodesys, I'm pretty sure Lodesys would not be able to show you they have the talent and the equipment to create almost anything that they're putting these patents on.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com. Fast and easy way to create, manage a website or blog. If you want to start a blog crusading for patent change, if you want to just get your word out there, you want to, you know, try to start moving your blog over from WordPress, movable type, TypePad, somewhere that is going to grow with you, try Squarespace out. They allow you to put in Twitter widgets, all kinds of social media buttons to connect your visitors and get them involved in the site. If you're looking at a blog or something and you're like, gosh, it looks so complicated, I don't know how to make the best use of it, Squarespace has all kinds of templates that can help you get started really fast. So try them out. Free trial. You don't have to even use a credit card. So it's no risk. You can go do it right now while I'm talking. Squarespace.com. Sign up for a free account. Start building your website. If you decide to purchase the service and keep it, use the code FOURCAST8. That's FOURCAST8. And get 10% off for 6 months. Squarespace is what I use to publish Sword and Laser, our podcast. It's what we use right here on Fourcast. If you go to FourCastPodcast.com, that's a Squarespace blog that we use to post up all the videos and all the links to the shows and the guests that we have on. So take a look at that. You like the way that looks? You could have something that looks like that too. Squarespace.com. Forecast 8 is the offer code for 10% off for 6 months, and we thank them for their support of Forecast. Let's go to the long-term predictions. These are more the looking off farther into the future, maybe outside our own lifetime. Brian, what do you got?
I think at some point in the next, we'll say 50 to 100 years, I think you're going to see more countries implement some sort of population restrictions, kind of similar to the stuff that you hear about in China. I think with all the medical advances that we're having, all these stories we keep hearing popping up of potential cures for cancer, the fact that they're able to start growing new organs for people, I think that is going to put such a strain on economies and space that you're going to see. And I don't know if the U.S. will be one of them, but I think you will see several countries over the next 50 to 100 years start to implement some of the similar rules that China has.
So let's say the U.S. suddenly has a huge population boom. And given our current culture and our current, our current lay of the land, what do we do to control? Like in China, we hear about, oh, you can only have one kid. And if it's a girl, well, maybe you can have another one until you get a boy, but that's it, two maximum or whatever. And we hear the kind of things like that, and we kind of go, oh, yeah, China, that's what they do. That's, you know, that's how they roll over there. How does America roll if this happens here?
Well, and that's why I say I'm not sure if it would ever work in America. I don't know if you could have that kind of control. I think it would take a society that maybe had a more socialist type government, a little bit more direct control over healthcare and things like that to be able to pull that off. Because I don't think in any other country you're going to be able to say, hey, have a boy. And if you can't have a boy, have a girl and then have a boy. But after that, you're out of luck. It's a very loose restriction. But I think you could see other nations where it would be something a little bit more structured, where they say, you know, you can only deliver one child. And I'm not saying crazy like forced sterilization or anything off the wall like that. And to be honest, I haven't fully figured out exactly how they would do it. But I think if you look at the way some of the countries are bursting at the seams, and not even a strain from just the size, but just the economic strain of having that many people in the system, I think it's inevitable at some point as people's lifespans continue to get longer and longer and we figure out more and more ways around medical conditions that they have to come up with some way to keep it from growing at the rate that it's growing. And I think that's more of a legislative thing maybe than a medical situation, but it really depends on the country that we're talking about.
Well, what's interesting is China is actually starting to reconsider their restrictions because their population growth is slowing. And we see that trend in developed countries where the population is actually declining. People are having fewer children and it's not replacing the population. But you bring up an interesting point. As healthcare gets better, even if we're not having children as fast as we used to, or as in as large amounts as we used to, we may still be having them enough to keep the population growing. Most people think we're going to hit peak population at around 9 billion and then start declining again. Annika, did you have an opinion on the population boom?
I like that you brought up the number for kind of our global population, because, you know, Brian, you brought this up as a country-specific thing, but I think it's sort of interesting if you look at it across countries, because we do have certain countries, you know, particularly in the developing world, that are sort of, as you said, bursting at the seams. But there are plenty of developed countries that are starting to face challenges where they have an aging population that's not reproducing. So I'm wondering if there are solutions that aren't necessarily medical and health related, but more related to immigration. So how do you start, you know, if the whole idea behind this is we're trying to get back to some sort of an equilibrium, it may turn out that there are immigration solutions that can start to meet those needs.
So isn't there a general decline in both Europe and the U.S. In childbirth rates? I thought there was some.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought we talked about it on the show, and it seemed like that was a trend that didn't show any real signs of slowing, and it was especially prominent in Europe. But on the whole, we're still. I mean, it's still an issue of we're having more babies than we're dying. Isn't that the overall picture of things?
Yeah, that's the big issue here, is that even though the birth rates are going down, that's more of a social issue. I think if you look at it, it's just because more and more people are choosing not to have families, whether you say it's for economic reasons or personal reasons. But the other areas, the lesser developed areas of the country, are still growing and bursting at the seams, and the child birth rate is still going, you know, through the roof in some of those countries. And I think it's making up for, you know, the nations like Europe and the United States. And I think that plays a part in it. But I also think when you look at the death rate, and if you start to scale that back, I mean, if you figure in the next 50 to 100 years, if somebody finds a cure for some of the major cancers and you get this whole organ donation thing sorted out, because they have these situations where they're able to grow, they basically take like the outer skin of an organ. I saw this on like Nova or something, but they take like the outer skin of an organ and regrow a human organ for transplant. There's no longer have to deal with transplant lists and things like that. As people live longer, even if the birth rate stays the same, you're not having as many people dying from these diseases, and that's going to put strains on the developed nations, because they're going to be where that health care is possible. So I think you have a kind of burning the candle at both ends. You have the undeveloped nations and their birth rates going up. But I like what Annika said about the immigration thing. Could you see a situation where the population gets so large in one area that it's just become incentives to emigrate to other countries? Where you almost like a dispersal of the population through immigration incentives.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Well, most people who study this think we are going to see populations peak in the developing countries as they get more affluent, as their economies develop, and then start to decline. But I like what you just said about the healthcare aspect of it. So even if it's not that the population gets huge or doesn't decline, we also have an aged population. Maybe they're not dying from cancer, and maybe we've got organ replacements, but they're still elderly. They're still retired. They may not want to work anymore. They may not be capable of working anymore, even though they're still technically healthier and alive. And that is a big worry in the United States as the population ages.
Also, they're not having kids. They're not having any kids. So
right.
what you've got is no young, educated people coming up in the ranks. Meanwhile, the rest of the world is doing that, and we're left with just, you know, a lot of old folks' homes. I mean, that's maybe extreme, but that's the worry, or at least that's a piece of the worry. So I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see how people handle this. Yes, Annika.
Yeah, I think you're right on, Scott. I was actually just out in Las Vegas this weekend and got to do a tour of the Lou Rubo Center for Brain Health. And they're really focused a lot on Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS now, and other brain diseases that are going to become a much bigger challenge, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide as we have aging populations. So I think most of the issues that we traditionally think about with population growth, which is, you know, a constraint of resources, we're going to get hit on the other end as well with healthcare and just dealing with a population that has a whole different set of issues than we've really ever had en masse before.
That's why we have to settle on Mars. So we need more room. All right, Annika, let's move over to you for your long-term predictions, more of the in 100 years sort of thing. What do you got for us?
Sure. So this prediction has to do with philanthropy. So I figured this is a little more long-term because that's something that's just so, been so ingrained in us as an institution. But I'm really starting to feel like the way that we've looked at it traditionally, which is a very, very one-way model, is probably going to start to peter out, and we're going to see a whole new shift in the way social good is created. So if you think about this one-way model we have right now, where essentially you solicit donations and then go and use it to do something. The two big challenges are that you're entirely dependent on the economic excesses of your patrons, right? So when you have an economic downturn, like we're in right now, charities and nonprofits get hit really hard. And then the other issue is that it really depends on your cause being en vogue, you know, which is sort of a nasty thing to have to think about. But it's like, oh, well, AIDS is really hot this year. Everyone loves breast cancer pink. And then, you know, next year it's not as stylish and the money dries up. So I think what we're going to have to do is start to look for more two-way models, where in addition to kind of receiving funding to go out and create social good, you're giving something back to your donors in exchange. So we're just starting to see the beginning of that with some organizations that are doing one-for-one models. And again, these aren't even nonprofits. So it might be that this whole concept of nonprofit philanthropy shrinks drastically, and you see more in the for-profit world. But these one-for-one models, like you see Warby Parker with eyewear, and Better World Books with books, or, you know, Tom's Shoes, the shoes, or even something like Charity Water. You know, Scott Harrison has built something really impressive there, because it's something intangible that he's giving back, which is sort of this branding. And, you know, it's kind of they've done very well to have people align up with their brand and get those intangible benefits. So I'm interested to see how this plays out.
It's funny how you basically described, like, if you want to do a TED talk in this day and age, you go to TED and say, here's my idea. And it's basically what you just laid out. It seems like a lot of TED talks talk about this very idea. So obviously it's kind of a hot, hot button topic, and people are interested in it. Do you see any way for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that just does so much good around the world, and there's so much money behind that, and, you know, they wipe out entire diseases and countries, and people don't even realize it's happening. How do they fit in that scenario? Or how do traditional charities like that, traditional philanthropy, how do they fit in that new way of thinking?
Well, even, you know, actually, just quickly, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I actually gave a TED talk a couple years ago that was very much related to this idea of building in sustainable goods. So I'm very familiar with the idea that TED's kind of overrun with this idea right now. But sure. I think if you look at Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that's still kind of dependent on Bill and Melinda Gates making the effort of moving, you know, shifting money over from what was largely earned from a for-profit venture over to a nonprofit venture. And if you can think about a way that and maybe it wouldn't be exactly this company, but a for-profit company like Microsoft turns, you know, actually builds into their business model something that sustainably creates that social good. So right now, they're, you know, you kind of use a bridge right now, which is Bill and Melinda Gates making the choice to do that. But if you actually start building businesses where that is fundamentally ingrained in the business model, you can see that something like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation could continue to do the work that they're doing, you know, indefinitely, and not at all dependent on Bill and Melinda Gates proper.
Brian, what do you think? Is this a good model for increasing philanthropy, increasing charity?
Well, it's funny, not to oversimplify, but if you think back to even just the commercials for, you know, adopting a cat or adopting a child or something, where they're like, hey, get this cute little tiger stuffed pet if you donate money. It starts at that concept where it's you get this piece in return by donating. And I think it seems to be an oversimplification of it, but it all kind of sits on that platform. We feel like we've gotten to the point where it's harder to just say, give us money, especially in this economy. And I think it makes more sense when you talk like Annika did about how you have to build it into your business model. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is great, but it's built on the foundation of a good amount of money that originally from Microsoft. And if you take a computer company, say you started a company just like Apple, and you build into it, say, okay, the purpose of this company is to create these computers and that benefit, you know, children in Africa, just to make it simple. And it's not too far off from how things have been done before. I think we're just looking at it from doing it from the core up instead of just building it into events. I mean, you could even say something, even though it's not always philanthropy, if you look at something like Kickstarter works on that same concept, that human nature to feel like you're being a part of something and to have something to show for it in the end. It's one thing to give you $20. It's another thing to give you $20 and get something in return so I can show to people that I was a part of this. And I think that's a bigger part of it than just saying, hey, I get these cool little shoes if I donate money. It's almost like a badge of honor to say, this is what I've done. Look, hey, look at me, I've donated. And as silly as that sounds, I think that's a core human feeling when it comes to this kind of thing. You know, it's the reason why rich people like to brag about what charities they're on the boards of and things like that. And it's very much playing to that at a level that the rest of us can operate on.
All right.
Yeah, it also seems like a simple thing to do. I've got a sponsor for a couple of my shows who give a dollar to Child's Play for everything you buy. And it's just a standard thing they do. And that's small. That's a little company. That's two or three guys running their business. And I think you could expand that out. And if it ever gets to the point where everyone's competing on how much they're giving to charity or how much good they're doing in the world, there are a lot worse places to be. So,
well, look at Humble Bundle. I mean, that's how that whole thing was built. That thing blew up.
Yep.
And Mac Heist, same sort of thing. Yep. Let's get crazy. Time for the really far out there forecast, a crazy ass prediction. Annika, we'll start with you. What do you got for us?
All right, this is literally far out there. I'm not an astrophysicist. This is really a thought experiment, not founded in science. But you know, when you look in a telescope and you see, you know, a star, for example, the light that you're seeing from that star has taken quite a while to get here. You know, depending on, you know, how far away it is, the speed of light. So technically, you could say you are looking into the future, right? You're seeing what this star looked like 5, 10, 20 minutes ago. And if you look even further out, you're seeing something, you're seeing the light from something that happened even for, you know, an hour, 2 hours, a day,
the past,
a year.
Really.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So my crazy far out idea is that eventually we'll get to a point where we have a telescope that is so strong that you can actually see so far into the past that you can see the Big Bang happen.
This is crazy ass, but kind of awesome ass, I guess. I love this idea. Be able to, because I do this with my kids. I'll take them outside and they all tell you stories about this, but I blow their minds. It's like, all right, you see that star right there? And that star is probably not even there now. And they're like, what do you mean, Dad? And I try to explain to them, you know, this happened so long ago. What we're seeing now took that long to get to us that we're going to be long gone by the time we see it's gone. It's probably already gone. And the idea that we could go back in time and see all the formation of this, of our galaxy, of our solar system, of the Milky Way, of this planet. How awesome would that be? I vote yes on your plan. That's a great idea.
Well, we can see the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is as far back as we can get, and we are not able to observe past that. So, and part of the theory is that there actually isn't light at the point of the Big Bang. But that doesn't mean your prediction is any less possible. I mean, it's quite possible that we'll come up with another way of observing that besides photons, besides light. There may be another way to detect that, which would be even more fascinating, I think.
Agreed. Yeah, I think it's an interesting thought experiment at the very least.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. So, Brian, you, how would you like to see the beginning of the universe? What would you do with that information?
Well, I could do dangerous things with that information. I think the big issue with that is distance. Because if this really is, I'm seeing something far, far away. So the further away I get from the object, the longer time I have to catch it. So I don't think you could go as far back ever as seeing the Big Bang. I think there is something there where if I could see far enough away, I could see further in the past, essentially. So while you couldn't see that, I think you could see a lot of things going on. The question is how far in the future and what crazy things are you going to see? You know, you discover an alien race is, you know, billions and billions of light years away. If you got far enough away from it with a power enough telescope, you could see back into their history using that theory. So I don't know if it'll happen, but it's pretty freaking sweet to think about.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to find how far the CMBR, the cosmic microwave background radiation, goes. Like, how far from the Big Bang to the CMB do we have to get? Like, how much more can we get? I'm not seeing an easy answer here. Maybe somebody in the chat room knows it, but yeah, good prediction.
I like that.
I love that.
I love that. All right, you're on the hot seat then, Brian. Your crazy ass prediction.
I think at some point in the future, we will be able to physically sell ideas and memories from other people. I think we will have gotten to a point where we've mapped not just the brain, but how the brain stores things, how it stores things, to the point where we could recreate data. And you literally could go and buy the thoughts of famous people and their memories and their experiences and have them implanted into your own brain.
Wow. So where do you start? Who do you want first? That's my question for you, Brian Huff.
You'd have to go, well, I guess if you wanted all the knowledge in the world, you'd have to go with somebody like Albert Einstein or just somebody who's just absolutely fascinating. And if you think about, if you were able to continue to recreate these thoughts, and if I could implant Albert Einstein's whole brain into my head, at least from a mapping standpoint, I could continue to innovate at the level and having the impact on the world that he did. And it's just fascinating to think if those people never died and their brains and the way their brains function could live on forever, you could have some just endless innovation from some of these people. Now, they probably cost, you know, billions.
So you're not just getting their thoughts like recorded. You're getting the ability to think like them.
Yeah, you're basically That's configuring cool. their brain, your brain internally like theirs. Because it is, you know, and I'm not a brain scientist, but, you know, all the little neurons and electrodes firing in your brain, we could figure out a way to map that, and everybody's would be unique, and you recreate that in somebody else's head. Basically rewire their brain to fire the same way that this person's brain would fire.
You'd have to be able to control it to the point that you would only let certain limited access. For example, you want the brilliance of Einstein, but you don't want, his weird thing with his cousin to keep cropping up right. in your head or you know what I'm saying, like you don't want people's baggage as much. That's why I've always said I want to get into my dog's head. I want to know what Daisy's thinking right now. She's looking at me like, what is in that dog's head right now? Because there's no weird baggage there.
Greg, and I would be Brian's afraid putting of Einstein everyone. In his head, and you're putting Daisy in yours.
Let me see where this is going.
But it's safe. I don't have to find all his little secret skeletons in his closet and stuff. Yeah,
but for all we know, that's what made him a genius. That's the problem when you start getting there messing with things. You
Daisy
may not be
or
able
Einstein?
That's what made Daisy a genius, yep.
She's her a cousin. Genius because of sniffing her butt. But, you know, it's...
Exactly.
Annika, would you do this? Would you,
Annika, what are you?
Would you
what
map
are you, what's
someone
your take?
Else into
your brain? Look, I think the most important question, Brian, is how exactly would we be buying and selling these? Would there be some kind of a patent involved?
Bringing it back.
Well, and that's, and you know, when you're talking, this may be even, you know, thousands of years in the future, maybe a government controlled thing. It may be something that we don't even know is actually taking place. When it got to general population, you know, just mass anarchy, and it would just all go to hell. But I think for the most part, it would, even thousands of years in the future, this is something that the government would be doing as some sort of project to, you know, I could see some massive economic fallout or, you know, nuclear war fallout, anything like that, and them trying to recreate the great minds of the world through this science. I think that's kind of where it would start. But yeah, I mean, eventually a market would be made for it, and we'd have to, like, patent Tom Merritt's brainwaves or whatever.
I got some black market Richard Feynman, and it was cut with Stephanie Germanotta. Oh, man.
It would have turned into some strange drug like Minority Report. You see people like going in the alley and shooting up with Einstein. And
yeah, right.
Having little euphoric moments.
Don't get any of that back alley Einstein. It's not the
thing. It's sort of weird thing.
All right, let's move to four questions, Scott.
Black tar Einstein. Black all right, it's four questions time. This means rapid fire style. We're going to ask you guys. We're not going to answer them. You guys are. We're going to ask you four question rapid fire style. You guys are going to have to answer those from the gut. Do not think too hard about it. I'm going to ask my questions. Vonica, are you sitting comfortably?
I am. I'm ready. Okay.
All right. Good deal. All right. Here we go. Question number one. How do you feel about the idea that government-controlled nanobots will be the voodoo dolls of the future?
The voodoo dolls of the future?
Yeah, like they can just say, I want Annika to feel pain, so I'm just going to tell one of my nanobots to, you know, do something terrible or whatever. This is my conspiracy theory. I just want to know how you feel about it.
I'm going to give that the unlikely stamp. When you talk about nanobots, it reminds me of, what was that movie? It was the one with it was the old, like, evil guy, and he had the kids, and they sent in the little cookie bots. Shoot, now I'm forgetting what this movie was called.
I don't know, but I want to see it.
It was a cartoon that came out last summer. But you had those
fantastic
little cookie bots that would go in and do all kinds of mayhem. So that's what I'm thinking of when you say nanobots. I don't think it's going to happen.
All right. Fair enough. When our food is able to talk to us and give us caloric and nutritional information verbally, what famous actor do you hope they base their artificial voices on?
Fran Drescher, probably. I feel like she would really, like, let you know what's going on in that donut and would make it real clear to you real fast that you shouldn't eat it.
Awesome.
Don't eat me.
Number three, when you build your lunar home on the surface of the moon, which is kind of redundant, which side will you build your lot, the light side or the dark side of the moon?
The light Oh, I think you should do it right on the split point, right? So that you can always have a little bit of both, and you can have your nap time and your play time. I think that's the best of both worlds.
Smart.
That's a good idea. You can be cold and super cold.
Yeah.
So that's a good idea.
Right. Put your bedroom on the night side.
That's right.
Front porch.
If you could have, finally, if you could have one famous fictional robot as your constant companion, who would you choose?
Oh, Wall-E, obviously. He was adorable. He was all about love and musicals. And robot cockroaches, all of my favorite things.
That is actually the correct answer. Nice job. You have passed four questions.
Thank you.
All right. Moving over to you, Brian. Are you ready for four questions?
Yeah, I think I'm all good.
All right, I'm not all of a sudden. Hold on a second. Woo! Boy, these four questions. Let me tell you. All right, question number one. Will dessert ever be legislated to precede the meal?
It should be if I'm president.
Thank God I'm voting for you. Question number two. What will be the weirdest animal to become popular food?
The weirdest animal to become popular food? An anteater.
Oh, that is weird.
I was thinking of those coffee beans.
How would it be served? Roasted snout, dude.
Roasted. That's exactly. It'd just be like a pig. It'd become like the new bacon.
Gross. Question number three, will the planet ever become just one big city?
Eventually. According to my population prediction comes through, then yes. So in order to defend that, I must say yes, it will.
What will it be called?
Scottopolis.
And question number four, when will English die as a language like Latin did?
It already has. When we got WTF and OMG in the dictionary, it's already dead.
I'd argue that that's actually a sign that it's still alive because we're growing. But
go back and look at Latin, see how many WTFs you find in any Latin dictionary.
VVV.
Yeah, VVV.
All right, that's it. You have answered four questions. Thank you very much, Brian. And thank you both for joining us today. It was really fun talking with you guys.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Annika, let folks know where they can find what you do online and how they can follow you.
Sure, that's right. So you can follow me on Twitter at Annika Jong, and you should definitely check out my company's website. It's www.bre.ad. We're representing for the great country of Andorra.
Ah, good old Andorra. And Brian, you too. Tell folks what you're doing online and where they can find you.
You can find my design and web-related stuff at lostinpixelation.com. Follow me on Twitter at @B_Huff. And, of course, occasionally on the Frog Pants Network if you're into podcasting.
Oh, I've heard of that Frog Pants Network, Scott.
That sounds familiar to me as well.
He brings this on so he gets two mentions.
Right. I have two things to say real quick. Tom Merritt, I think your four questions, you were channeling Philip K. Dick today. Something about those questions, very Philip K. Dick. If you guys are fans of that, you'll see all sorts of things.
It comes
there.
From living in Santa Rafael for a year.
I guess so. And I would point people's direction. If people are interested in the big argument and conversation about free-to-play coming to video games or to everyone everywhere, I might point their browsers to theinstance.net. They should check out our latest episode of The Instance podcast. While it's usually very World of Warcraft related, we had a huge discussion at the top of the show about what free-to-play is and will be and what this industry is about to go through as a result. So people should check that out. And as always, great forecast. It was wonderful being on with everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Again, don't forget to leave comments at our website, forecastpodcast.com, or send us an email, forecastpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
It's 32 years away.
Yay! We actually got the show.